Gorgias is saying basically this, that rhetoric needs to be governed by some higher power in order to be used rightly. It's just a technique. At the top of the passage, the same passage in 38, though, he says that it gathers together and holds under itself all powers, which would seem to mean that it doesn't need to be ruled by anything above itself, but it is the highest art and the final authority because it makes everything else effective. Now, this is a contradiction, and Socrates smells this contradiction in here and in the rest of this little discussion, relentlessly pursues Gorgias until he shows that he has contradicted himself. And Gorgias goes on the top 39, talking about how people who teach rhetoric, the sophists who go around and are driven out of cities and become unpopular, are really being treated unjustly. And Gorgias himself had been, by this time, driven out of a couple of cities. Argos sent him out of town and banned his lectures because they thought that he was having a bad effect on people, corrupting the youth and so forth. And he says, look, you know, I'm just a technician. I just build the bombs. It's the generals who drop them. You know? It's not guns that kill people. It's people who kill people. And, of course, these are all true, right? This is true. It's unimpeachably true. Guns don't walk out there on their own accord, walk into liquor stores, and start shooting. They have to have some little jackass holding them and pulling the trigger. And it's the person who uses it that decides to use it well or badly. The issue of right use or just use is brought up here. He says, look, he's talking about they here at the very first line of 39 are the teachers. They imparted their skill to these men to use justly. Now, the same word can be translated as rightly, DK, just or right, to be used rightly against enemies and doers of injustice in defending themselves, not in starting something. But these men, perverting it, use the might and the art incorrectly. Those who taught are not, therefore, base, nor is the art either blameworthy or base on this account. But I think those who did not use it correctly, those are the blameworthy ones. That's unimpeachable. But poor Gorgias is admitting that he needs some other art above his own to govern its use properly. And that's what wisdom claims to be. Only it doesn't claim to be an art in the proper sense. But it is analogous to the arts on a number of points, and so it's always tempting to try and think of it as a kind of higher order art. And Gorgias is very proud of his technical abilities. Then what Socrates does is he sort of butters Gorgias up before he delivers the final blow. He says, "Now, Gorgias, there are two kinds of men. One kind of man wants to win an argument, and the other kind of man wants to get to the truth. Now, the kind of man who is concerned primarily with winning will never allow himself to be refuted, even though he's wrong. Therefore, he'll never discover his errors. Okay? He'll be stubborn. He'll be a jackass. He'll filibuster. He'll run you down, and he'll walk away and feel that he's not been defeated, and that's all that counts. The other kind of man who's interested in the truth is happy to be refuted if he's wrong, because by getting rid of his false beliefs, he gets closer to having the true beliefs. And so, Gorgias, what kind of man are you? Are you a man who wants to win, or are you a man who wants to know the truth?" And Gorgias says, "Well, Socrates, of course, I'm the kind of guy who wants to get to the bottom of things. I want to know the truth." But he also makes another kind of qualifying remark, and this is the center of page 40. A little above the center, it says Gorgias, G-O-R, colon. "But I say that myself, namely, there are two kinds of men, and some want to know the truth, and others want to win." And he says, "I myself, Socrates, am also such a one as you indicate, a lover of truth. But perhaps we must nevertheless give thought also to the situation of those present. Quite a while ago, you see, before you came, I made a display for those present of many things, and now perhaps we shall prolong it too far if we converse." Now, this is typical Gorgias, right? There's a time and a place for everything. If you go on too long, it loses the effect, right? He's concerned with the truth, but he's also concerned with his audience. Now, there can be a noble and a base way of being concerned with your audience. You can hold fast to the truth and still accommodate how you speak and what you say to your audience, or you can be more concerned with what your audience thinks than what the truth is. But Gorgias is the rhetorician, and so he's considerate of who's there. He's saying, maybe these people are tired, Socrates. There's a time and a place for everything. Maybe this isn't the time. Well, Callicles and Chaerephon say, oh no, You know, go on. And there was a big uproar from the other people. They wanted to hear it. And so at the bottom of page 40, Gorgias says, "It would indeed be shameful after all this, Socrates, for me to be unwilling, since I myself made the proclamation to ask whatever anyone wishes. Well then, if it seems good to these men, converse and ask what you wish." He has a sense of shame. That's something that Callicles and Polus are conspicuously lacking in. Callicles more than Polus. But Gorgias has a sense of shame, which means he has a sense of honor, which means that he's a gentleman, he's a decent man, fundamentally. And this is why Socrates finds it so easy to trap him, because as soon as the issue of justice is made clear to Gorgias, he says, "I'm all for that." But then that completely traps him, because he can't claim that his art is the highest art there is if it needs to be applied justly. It means that he has to look above himself to what philosophy provides. Okay. And they go on, and to make a long story short, Socrates says basically this. If somebody comes to you, Gorgias, and he doesn't know the just things, are you going to teach it to him? And he says, "Oh, of course, yes, I'll teach it to him." And so when they're done with you, they all know justice. They either knew what the just things were before they came to you, or you've taught it to them, right? Yes. So rhetoricians all know the just thing. Well, Socrates has this view that if you know what's just, you do what's just. If you really know what's just, you do it. If all rhetoricians know what's just, then they all naturally, as a matter of course, do the just thing. So, Gorgias, why were you worried that some people might use rhetoric unjustly? If they're rhetoricians, they know the just, and if they know the just, they do the just. Okay. And Gorgias agrees with this. He wants to be a good guy. He ends up arguing here that, by nature, rhetoric is unconditionally and always good. If you're a rhetorician, you know the just, and if you know the just, you do the just, so rhetoric is always just. That means that there's no condition under which you can be a rhetorician and be an unjust man, which is news to all of us, right? What Gorgias has agreed to here is that rhetoric is unconditionally good. And that's an extraordinary thing to think about rhetoric, given all that we know about it. Now, what Gorgias has done so far is this. He's made the following claims. And he's basically claimed that rhetoric equals wisdom. And the points at which rhetoric resembles wisdom are this. Wisdom is liberal in the sense that it's free, okay? Free of ordinary practical considerations. This is the original sense of liberal arts. Liberal arts doesn't mean education by people who are all liberals. Okay? It means it's a description of the arts, not the educators. Okay, and it means that they're liberated from mere natural necessity, the necessity of getting a job. It's liberal, it's gentlemanly, it's clean, because it exists in and through speeches, through words. Okay? The other point, second point, is this. Rhetoric makes its practitioners the masters in the political sense, the political masters of all the practitioners of the other arts. Rhetoricians rule all other artisans. And Aristotle, surprisingly enough, uses this point in the Nicomachean Ethics when he talks about a master art, which is sort of the analogy for philosophy. He says that it's the politician, the statesman, and these were all orators, the most persuasive orators were the ones who had power, right, rules all the other arts of the city. And that's true. There are certain arts that are banned, you know, that are illegal. The arts of prostitution, these are illegal. Other arts are regulated in their use. The arts of building nuclear weapons. You just can't clip out something in popular science and buy a kit to do that. Much as Saddam Hussein would want. You know, you can't just get a hold of all these things. Only certain people can practice these under a certain legal condition. The art of murder is highly prescribed in its use. Hangman's art can only be exercised under certain conditions. Not to say that hangmen are murderers. There's a sense in which, for Plato, wisdom has the right to rule all the other arts. Yeah. Right? Politically, and as well. This whole wild notion of the philosopher king. The fact is that although Socrates doesn't necessarily believe that philosophers literally should hold the office of king, he clearly believes that the people who do have the proper title to rule have to be wiser than the people who rule on average, and that the best way of doing that is to have the ruling class philosophically educated. And so he's the advocate of a kind of aristocratic society where, you know, people are bred to rule and educated throughout their entire lives in order to rule by philosophers who aren't kings, but they're in effect kings behind the kings, the unacknowledged legislators of mankind. Now, another point in which rhetoric resembles wisdom is this. Rhetoric makes all other arts effective. That differs from wisdom, because wisdom doesn't make things merely effective, right? It makes them good. But, you know, it's very common to define utility, goodness as utility. Effectiveness, usefulness. It's a common error. Peter Singer, you know, this new bioethicist at Princeton, is the most, you know, sort of herky-jerky, comical, wind-up utilitarian you can imagine. Suffering is bad, pleasure is good. Maximize the pleasure and minimize the suffering. What's good is what's useful in this hedonistic kind of way. And he's the philosopher for our times. You know? He's the philosopher who wants to grant animals rights and take away people's. And the last point in his rhetoric is unconditionally good, or just, as he puts it here. And that's a claim that philosophy makes about itself. But at the same time that he makes these claims, and it sounds so much like philosophy, ultimately it fails, because it's still a technique. And as a technique, it can never be enough. Techniques always have to have wisdom from outside. And indeed, when he argues that it's unconditionally good, he can only argue that by, in a sense, fusing rhetoric with philosophy, and making the rhetorician not just a rhetorician, a technician, but, in a sense, a professional. Because that's really the definition of a profession. It's a set of morally neutral techniques fused with a kind of ethical code that's supposed to orient it towards doing the good, so that simply by fulfilling the job description of being a doctor or a lawyer or a theologian or a teacher, you by necessity do something good, which is different from mere arts and crafts, which are always morally neutral and therefore have this application issue put to them in a more, you know, in a different way. Simply by being good at making money, for instance, you don't necessarily do anything good. But by being a good doctor, you do. We've basically gotten to the point where poor Gorgias has been tongue-tied. He's been hog-tied. He's been defeated. And he's been defeated by this internal contradiction. On the one hand, he wants to argue that he's merely a technician, a very good technician. Yet on the other hand, he wants to argue that his technique is unconditionally good. And really, we see that it can only make that claim by fusing itself with what philosophy aims to provide, which is wisdom. And so what Socrates has done here is he's defeated at least the initial statement of one of the most famous, justly famous, and really awe-inspiring sophists of the time, that what they teach is the queen of all the arts and sciences, that really is the thing that orders and rules everything else by right, as well as in fact. And the reason why Socrates can do this to Gorgias, he can defeat him, is that he's depending on Gorgias' own good nature. Gorgias is a gentleman. He's oriented toward things that are fine and wants to avoid things that are shameful. So when the issue of justice is pressed on him, he's going to say, I'm all for it. But if he's all for it, he can't maintain his own claim to supremacy. And he has to allow for philosophy. Now, what happens when we start reading the Polis thing is we're going to find that Polis immediately recognizes Gorgias' weakness. Gorgias is too ashamed to say the wicked things that are necessary to defend rhetoric as the queen of the sciences or the arts. And in order to do that, one has to dethrone the good. One has to get rid of notions like that. And Gorgias won't do that. Polis tries. Socrates, you know, defeats him. And Callicles is even more vigorous about it. And what makes Callicles such an effective opponent of the good, interestingly enough, is the fact that he's deeply philosophical in a certain in his sophistry. And ultimately, he argues for a notion of natural right, what's right by nature. Whereas these gentlemanly sophists, Gorgias and Polus, are defeated because they have fairly conventional views of what's right and wrong. Well, what Callicles does is he totally overturns the conventional views of morality by appealing to a notion of natural right. And in so doing, he makes himself a far more formidable opponent than the others, because Socrates, of course, believes that ultimately you have to fight these things out on the ground of appealing to nature, not conventional morals. But ultimately, what Socrates tries to do is he has a conception of what's right by nature that revalidates most of the moral conventions, whereas someone like Callicles simply rejects them across the board. So anyway, Callicles is interestingly Nietzschean, and he's a wonderful hedonist, and he's a great rhetorician, too. He's in some ways even more respectable than Gorgias. He's less of a gentleman, but he's more worthy of respect for his extreme tough-mindedness and freedom from prejudice, which is one of the characteristics of philosophers. Has the argument of the first with Gorgias made sense? It is a polemos. It is a war. And it's a war for supremacy in issues that are far more important than political supremacy. It's a war for supremacy amongst the architectonic arts, the arts that organize and control other things. It's really a war between philosophy and the pursuit of wisdom and technique for what is enough, ultimately, for what purpose? To lead man to well-being. Gorgias is a believer in the illusion of modern times, which is that technique is enough. And that all you need is are well-skilled technicians and a large enough system that organizes them and trades information and goods between them and so forth by PR, but also the market economy. Market economy is a method of conveying information, coordinating people's behavior, persuading people through advertising and sales, and prices convey information and they persuade. And so the world we live in is a world of opinion. I mean, the stock market, there's no real value in the stock market. Everything is valued in terms of expected future earnings, not in terms of the actual substance that the thing has now. Now, I'm not saying that we should just stop it. But you get all these new startup companies and suddenly
.com stocks.
Yeah, they're going shooting. A lot of this internet stuff is purely speculative and it's based upon expectations, not upon substance. But that's the kind of world we live in. You know, we live in a world of technicians coordinated by large-scale systems of information exchange and material exchange, and all of it, you know, lubricated by a great deal of opinion and deception and illusion. And the question becomes, is that enough for well-being? It's only enough for well-being if we define well-being in terms of material progress, because the system we have has been enormously effective at creating a lot of material stuff, and enormously effective at lengthening people's lifespans and preventing people from dying of senseless illnesses and accidents and things like that. There's no question about that. But the whole issue of what does it all mean, and how does this relate to human well-being properly understood, that's harder. And we have a tendency, and this is partly the tendency of moral relativism, but also just the weight of recognizing the immensity of the world system and how no one seems to really control it or even understand it. We all have a tendency to think we just have to throw up our hands and not even raise those questions. It's just such an amazing weight. How could you ever shift it? Where would you stand to lever this in one direction or another? There is no place outside of it anymore. Yet that's the question that Socrates is posing us and later philosophers too. Is technique enough? Are systems enough for well-being? Are things enough for well-being? Or do you have to have wisdom, which involves an orientation towards the good and concerns with things like moderation, courage? Courage is almost obsolete in our society. It's obsolete in the sense that the sign of its obsolescence is our obsession with safety and comfort. People are so obsessed with being safe and comfortable that they don't take risks. They're risk averse, and even and they don't make moral stands. Well, that's all I'm going to say. If you've got questions, fire away. The Sophists were teachers of rhetoric, but they were not the same as the rhetoricians. And there were people who learned rhetoric just by participating in politics, just sort of empirically getting the knack of it, right? The Sophists came along and tried to make it into a kind of art. And Socrates believes that it is possible to have an art of rhetoric, a true art of rhetoric, although he, in this text, he's extremely critical of sophistry's claim and says it's not an art, it's just a kind of fumbling empirical knack of persuasion. It's not art either. But he clearly recognizes that it's possible to make an art of it, and to some extent you have to grant that people like Gorgias and Hippias and all the other sophists really did make some strides into turning rhetoric into an art. Okay, so they were teachers of rhetoric who taught from art, as opposed to the traditional sorts of teachers of rhetoric, the traditional way of learning rhetoric, which is to learn it by simply getting in there and persuading people, practice. You see this distinction in the Theages, when Demodocus brings Theages to Socrates and says, you know, well, teach the boy, he wants to be a big man. And Socrates first says, well, why don't you, Theages, go and study with your father and the other gentlemen and follow what they do? Theages says, but, you know, Socrates, I heard that you proved that, you know, this doesn't work, because if these gentlemen knew had something to teach, they'd surely teach their sons, but they don't end up doing that. So I want to go to a professional. And so Socrates says, well, why don't you try a sophist then? You know, so there's a recognition that there's more to sophistry than just a blind kind of knack, that there is an art quality to it. And that as an art, it's relatively formalized, it has annexed to it philosophical reflections on what makes rhetoric possible, like the denial of truth, and so on and so forth. So the Sophists were a rare breed of teachers who were philosophical in their foundations and reflective in the way that they tried to turn rhetoric into an art that could be really taught in terms of principles as opposed to taught by imitation. It's one of the disputed Platonic dialogues. Well, they left it out because they had uncritically accepted the critics of the dialogue's claim, I think. I don't buy a lot of these arguments that these things are spurious. Oftentimes they're based on really silly claims. Just really silly claims. Socrates could have said that. Why? Well, gee, it would seem so radical or impious. You know, Socrates was really very pious. Or they'll switch it around and say, well, the Theages is filled with very strange, superstitious-sounding ghost stories. Socrates was too rational to believe in that. This is one of the arguments that's made, but they don't recognize that Socrates' audience is a kid from the country, is a kind of bumpkin, and is extremely superstitious. And so Socrates knows exactly how to persuade him of the power of his daimonion by telling these sort of spooky ghost stories, you know, with all these heavy-handed lessons about how you should follow the daimonion. And the daimonion says, Theages, you can't be my student. And you ignore it at your own peril. That's the kind of argument that was given against it. But I think you can rebut it very simply by just reading the dialogue as a dramatic whole. It makes perfect sense for Socrates to say the oddball things he says, given who he's saying it to. And in that, he's no different to Socrates from any of the other Socratic dialogues. So most of these dialogues have been excluded on the basis of claims like that, that simply don't respect the fact that Socrates was a rhetorician and he adapted his speeches to his audience too. And so he'll say different things to different people. There's no reason to think that, in terms of style and word choice and stuff like that, there's no reason to think that it's not authentic. You wouldn't expect differences of style between one dialogue by Plato and another, really. Although you can say, well, his style would develop over time. But, I mean, one way that you can say, well, this work is spurious is if the style of it radically diverges from the style of the other accepted works. But none of these disputed works radically differs in style. None of them at all. I read all these claims. There's a work by Aristotle called On Virtues and Vices, and it's dismissed as pseudo-Aristotelian. And the only reason that I've ever been able to find is that they treat it as a product of a later syncretism to try to stick Plato and Aristotle together and make them consistent, which is presupposes that they were radically different, which is an extremely widespread but extremely questionable claim. How could they be so radically different? Aristotle was Plato's student for 20 years, and many of their teachings are very, very similar if you know how to read them. But somebody says, well, you know, Aristotle doesn't make these kinds of distinctions, whereas Plato does, and so this is just an attempt to slap two heterogeneous thinkers together. But even if you read Aristotle carefully, you find evidence that he actually would make the same kind of distinctions that are supposedly spurious and not part of his thought. So there's just a lot of crap that floats around out there. And given how much crap there is and how questionable a lot of it is, the prudent thing to do is simply to accept the tradition. And for more than 2,000 years, there had been no serious question about the authenticity of the 35 Platonic dialogues that were accepted in antiquity up until the last century. And there's been no serious dispute about the authenticity of many works by Aristotle that have been declared pseudo-Aristotelian in the last century. It doesn't really matter, in a way, because if you're really interested in philosophy, the only thing is what can you learn from it, not who wrote it. You know, that's merely an issue of attribution for footnotes. It's just a sort of vice of people who read, I think, especially philologists, you know, people who are grammarians and linguists and so forth. They tend to see that they tend to lose the forest for the trees. They tend to have very naive and inflexible kinds of thought patterns in dealing with interpreting texts. And they also have this kind of arrogance that, well, they know Greek better than Plato did. Or they know Plato better than Plato did, and so they can say, "Well, this is a badly expressed thought. This is unworthy of Plato." Or, you know, you find this kind of pomposity, and it's just a sign of being cooped up in the study too long and not concerned with the questions of truth, but questions of footnotes and nitpicking and attribution and grammar and punctuation and stuff like that. And it's damaging to the soul, but it's also damaged the corpus that's been brought down to us from the past. Because texts that are really filled with wisdom, whoever wrote them, are not read because they're no longer attributed to Plato, which is just nuts. Whoever wrote them, they're still worthwhile, and they still tell you something about Socrates. And if you read them carefully and treat them as dramatic works and recognize that there's a rhetorical dimension to them and that things will change from time to time and speaker to speaker because of that, it's not difficult to see the coherence of these disputed texts with all the other Platonic texts. In fact, it's very easy to see the coherence. So I'm very skeptical of a lot of this stuff. It just strikes me as nutty. And in a way, beside the point for our task here.